knowing that the most common kind of training injury in our population is lower body overuse musculoskeletal injuries largely attributable to running, I tend to recommend pretty strongly against the concept of a recovery run in our population. If you are a fantastic, like half marathon, marathon, or longer distance runner, and you want to do a shakeout, couple 2, 3 mile run and call it a recovery run, I'm not going to stop you. You know what you're doing. But in a general purpose with our population, if you're going to grab a platoon or a company or something like that, don't take them for a run and think you're doing recovery.
Hello, guys. We don't have a guest this week.
Nope, just us.
It's Alex and I. And we have gone back and forth quite a bit internally as a committee of two to create or lay the foundations for a 101 series. It seems that we have a certain chunk of our audience that really appreciates and likes the conversations with the sort of performance peripherals, is the phrase that we're going to use. The Charles Vogels of the world, the Matt Larsons of the world. But then we also have a contingent that really is interested in more of the 101 information around training. So recovery, programming, strength, endurance. We've done a couple of these episodes in the past. We're going to revisit some of that. We're going to flesh that out a little bit more. So we're putting this out publicly to hold ourselves accountable to the fact that in upcoming episodes, you'll start to see some 101 type stuff. And if there is anything specific you want us to dive into, hit us up in the DMs, Alex.
So we're starting with recovery for a pretty simple reason. And that is that I get questions about this stuff all the time. There's tons of content on social media, people hopping in saunas, people jumping in ice baths, all different things where people are making some pretty serious claims about their performance and recovery benefits. I get lots of DMs from you guys. We've promised to go deep on some of these things. To be honest, I'm not going to consider this episode really going deep on any given one. If you guys are interested, shoot us a note after this, shoot us an email, whatever. Let us know if you want to deep dive on any of this stuff, and we can find a more qualified researcher or professional in the space to deep dive some of these things.
Yeah, we're not the goal, super qualified.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the point here, too, is that the goal here is not to do like a super in-depth research review on the topics. The goal here with the 101 series in general is to give you like enough knowledge to go be effective in doing something at a relatively beginner level. It's not going to make you an expert, but it will give you some actionable, practical information you can go use. And if you want to go deeper, you are more than welcome to.
Enough to be dangerous.
It's about right.
So where shall we begin?
Well, I think we got to have a conversation first about like what the heck recovery is. And I think some important disclaimers as we go through this. One thing that stood out, I'll say up front, we're going to reference a lot of studies here. We might not talk about all of them in here. I can slam a bunch of them into the show notes that you guys can go look for though. But I looked at easily 20, 25-ish studies, like a half dozen each on several of these topics. I did not read them front to back, every single aspect of the study. What I did was look at top level takeaways, but also enough of a look at the methodology to figure out what they were actually studying, because recovery can be defined very differently. You can talk about short-term recovery. Like if you do a sprint, what's the best way to recover between that and your next sprint in a limited number of seconds or minutes? You could look at recovery in the sense of what you do overnight between one session and another session. There's a bunch of, you could look at like 48, 72 hour recovery timelines, and acute and chronic effects are going to be different. As a simple explanation of that, right? Exercise acutely reduces performance. If I work out right now and then test myself in a couple hours or even the next day, I will perform worse than I did right before that workout. But chronically, over time, with enough of it, it improves performance. We all know that. Same thing goes on with recovery. Some things might acutely reduce performance or acutely, in a brief period, increase performance, and they might do the opposite in the longer term. And we're going to talk about that with a few of these in here. So keeping that in mind makes this a little bit more complicated than it might seem on the surface. We're not going to be able to just say this is good, this is bad. We have to talk about how it's applied.
Yeah. So we've got a list of different things. We'll kind of run through them, cite some of the research. A lot of this, well, I should say all of this research will be included in the show notes. So we'll have links to everything if you guys are interested in diving a little bit deeper. But yeah.
I'll do some other fast disclaimers before we roll into it. One very frustrating thing as you dig into the research is that a lot of the research is on like blood biomarkers or potential indicators of fatigue, and those aren't always indicators of something bad. Reducing inflammation might be good, but it might also slow down actual performance recovery because inflammation is a normal part of healing. Blood lactate clearance is a really popular thing that a lot of these studies look at, but blood lactate clearance is not necessarily a good proxy for recovery for a variety of reasons. You have to like actually go at least one or two layers deeper than just like the top line takeaways from these to realize like whether or not you're actually looking at whether it improved performance. Another big one before we dive into actual specific topics is the difference between trained and untrained athletes in a specific activity. How a marathon runner responds to an active recovery run is going to look a lot different than how somebody who never runs would respond to the exact same run. But the same applies to people who are accustomed to different levels of training. Their recovery timelines are going to be way, way different. So it also changes based on the study population.
Well, and we don't really know. Well, I shouldn't say we don't know much about fatigue, but like fatigue is still kind of out there in terms of how we actually, like what it entails. You could get into some of the biopsychosocial stuff.
And there's different categories of fatigue. You can talk about local muscular fatigue. You can talk about central nervous system fatigue. If you guys want to nerd out, go look up central governor theory kind of stuff.
Oof. Well, and I think too, like a lot of these, as with most studies, they tend to stick to the biological and the physiological. And there's probably an entirely separate episode that we could record with people about the psychological component of recovery. So,
you will notice that on a few of these, we're going to say that the evidence does not support their use for performance/recovery, but then you're going to say, what the heck, all these pro athletes I follow
but
do
it
all
feels
these things.
Good.
And sometimes things just feeling good is good enough to make a difference, at least psychologically. And
or,
a psychological difference can improve performance.
Or you look like an idiot at the Olympics covered in KT tape and bruises from getting cupped.
That is also true.
So that world exists too. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with one that is actually, somewhat surprisingly, available on almost any major military installation. This one's been popular on the Soch Meads a lot recently. Let's start with sauna.
My God, do people really say Soch Meads?
Well, I did. They're going to start now.
No, they're not. Don't ever do that again. Ugh.
Drew, do you sauna?
Do I shauna? I say shauna with a Finnish accent because every time I see a shauna, it's always shaman from Finland. No, I don't sauna. I do walk past the sauna where I swim because it's right next to the pool, and it's typically overcrowded, which is kind of a gross thing to think about. But no, I don't sauna. I've thought about building a sauna.
Ooh, backyard sauna is a
sauna
cool
in
move.
The backyard with.
Yeah. I just went to Easter brunch actually, and the hosts had a sauna in their backyard, and I was extremely jealous. It made me want one.
That seems like the type of person that would host an Easter brunch.
It was a fantastic brunch, first of all.
Did you sauna?
I did not sauna. It was already warm outside and stuff, and I was in my Easter attire.
Mm.
So before we dig into whether sauna is good or not, it reminds me of a funny realization. Brand new Second Lieutenant Alex, 1st Brigade, 4th Infantry Division, Fort Carson.
With a reading list. If you
very, very excited. I did not. Yeah, at this point, at the time of this story, I had not yet gotten that audacious. But I remember it was one of those moments where you realize like what you've gotten yourself into by joining the army, where it's like not exactly what the ads said and things like that. So I walk into the gym that like is going to be my gym for the next couple of years for the first time. And I noticed a sign that says no sauna during PT. Come to find out the reason why is because people thought that like, because you were sweating, you were exercising. So they would just sit in the sauna as their exercise. That was a minor issue. The bigger issue is the next sign I come across, which is the sign that says no sleeping in the bathrooms during PT. And this existed because on too many occasions, I don't know how many is too many, but they caught soldiers just sitting on toilets asleep instead of exercising during PT.
Jesus. That's not surprising, to be honest.
Right. I can go back on topic now, because before we started recording, Drew said we were going to try and keep this thing to an hour, and I'm already burning a ton of time on stupid stories. We'll so let's go. My short version take on saunas after reading like four or five studies here, experimenting with it myself, talking to people who use it. It's important to note sauna itself is an additional stressor. Like you are putting stress on your body when you go into the sauna.
Objectively.
Yeah. Speaking. It's just heat stress. That's literally what it is.
A stressor.
Applied consistently, there are certainly studies to support that it can enhance cardiovascular performance and heat tolerance in the long term. Now, whether or not it enhances cardiovascular performance more than just doing cardio would have is open for debate.
I'd be very interested in why they're making that. The heat tolerance makes a lot of sense. Why the hell would it make
it's really hard to separate those things, right? Like if you get faster at running, is it because your cardiovascular performance was better or because you could tolerate the heat better? Like it's separating those things is kind of tough. But there is, and you can go click on some of the studies. There is evidence, even in not hot environments, you can see some cardiovascular benefits after consistent use of the sauna. Oh, but here's where the warning comes in. We talked earlier about the difference between acute and chronic effects. A single sauna session absolutely will negatively impact your performance in the short term following that session, to include the day following that session. Pretty good study in here using swimmers. You throw swimmers in a sauna session, they are going to perform worse the day after. They're just dealing with some extra stress, a little less hydration, things like that. My bottom line is, if like sauna is relaxing for you and you can fit it in, I'd say sure. Like you consistently, you're probably going to see some benefits. A particular scenario is if you know you're going to something like NTC or JRTC, saunaing for the few months prior to that to improve heat tolerance might be a smart idea. But I would not sauna immediately before or even really the day before a particularly intense session, competition, event, things like that. And I would also probably choose actual cardio over the sauna if you had to prioritize.
Absolutely. I don't care what the studies say. Like that's unequivocally true. But I do think that there, I don't know if this falls into the recovery category or not, but there's probably an argument to be made about saunas and the kind of mindfulness space. It seems like a lot of those people, along with maybe cold plunges, which we'll get into.
We'll be talking about that soon. Yeah. I will also shout out, not necessarily performance focused, but there are indications that consistent sauna use may have beneficial effects on blood pressure, arterial stiffness, and other cardiovascular disease risk factors.
I know we're about to talk about cold plunges, but did you come across anything about contrast therapy? Sauna to cold plunge, back to sauna, back to...
It was on my outline to dig into contrast therapy. I ended up basically running out of time, so I did not get a chance to read any of the serious contrast therapy research. I have heard things and I have seen investments made in it to include in like SOCOM facilities. They have contrast therapy stuff available and stuff like that, but I have not personally dug into it. And frankly, my biggest reason for not digging into it is I don't know how much of our audience has access to the tools to do contrast therapy, really.
Well, I mean, you could turn your shower hot and then cold.
Sure.
And then hot and then cold. But anyway, I guess to put a bow on the sauna conversation, I think, and I'll probably have this opinion on most of these, if it makes you feel good, go for it. Don't stay in there for too long. Kind of like a jacuzzi. I think there's a time limit on these kinds of things. But like I mentioned, it is a good place for some mindfulness stuff. I mean, otherwise you're kind of just sitting there. So you might as well take advantage of that. Because as we mentioned before, there is the physiological and biological component of recovery. And then there's the psychological component as well. So I think of all of these, this one probably more than most makes room for that type of modality, I guess.
I'm a huge fan of sauna after a workout where you're like high levels of arousal or whatever, and you want to like relax and calm down before you go on with your life. Huge fan of it for that, which is why I get super mad when people in the saunas are either like playing their music so loud I can hear it, or there's one particular lifter at the gym I currently work out at who loves to talk really loudly to other people in the sauna. And
That's weird.
I just leave. If he's there, I just leave. I just don't do it.
I don't know if I'd combine arousal and sauna just as like a...
We have hopefully adults listening to this episode who understand psychological arousal as a concept.
It's a military audience, so you never know.
That's also true. They're probably snickering at me.
Yeah, so keep your voices down, keep your phones off, keep your towels on, and I think the sauna gets the green light from Mops and Mos.
Yeah. With like the asterisk of people overpromise on a lot of these things.
Oh, for sure.
For basically everything we're going to cover today, if you had to choose between it and just like getting in the training you were hoping to get in during the week, just get in the training. Anyway, moving on. Cold plunge. Again,
cold plunge.
Like absolute dominance on Instagram. There's an insane amount of cold plunge content going around right now.
Joe Rogan, baby.
Like a slightly concerning number of people I know have invested in cold plunge bath things and stuff. I've dabbled in cold plunge a little bit. I've tried it, not to the extent that I've done sauna. I haven't made it like a habit ever, but I've tried it out just to make sure I know what people are talking about and stuff. It's an interesting experience. You get that like cortisol rush or whatever when you jump in. You like involuntarily gasp. It takes a few seconds to get yourself under control. And then as long as you like stay focused and calm, you can control it pretty well for a while after that. It's pretty neat. But we're here to talk about recovery. And I think that for the most part, from the general consensus of all the literature I'm looking at, I would say that cold plunges are probably counterproductive to recovery.
Physiologically.
Yes. And I've even seen a little bit of literature now saying that it might have a potential application pre-workout as like a way to stimulate the nervous system. Honestly, that also seems a little bit weird and logistically complicated. Going back to what Drew was saying about sauna, that doesn't mean I don't think there's no value in cold plunges. Some fun history. Friend of the pod, previous guest, Nick Tiller, has some good content on cold plunging. Cold plunging does, in fact, go back thousands of years. Famous Stoic Marcus Aurelius talked about cold plunging as part of his routine. He talks about voluntary discomfort and like the perceived benefits of that. So if you are going after it from a stoic mindset, from a actively seeking out discomfort for potential mental and discipline benefits that come from it, those all might be valid. I have nothing against it if those are your purposes. But if you start making claims about how it's amazing for recovery and performance, that's probably just not true.
Well, I think it seems to come up a lot in conversations around inflammation and this idea, actually, like all this post-workout inflammation. I mean, like, fair, but you also have the emerging, maybe not even emerging at this point, maybe just evidence showing that inflammation is sort of a key piece of recovery.
That actually brings up a really good point, because one of the moments where cold plunging, I think, got a ton of like mainstream exposure, or at least among the fitness circles exposure, Ice Barrel, at least last year, sponsored the CrossFit Games, and there was tons of video content of athletes right after events jumping in ice baths. And that brings us back to what we said at the beginning about like short-term versus long-term recovery. At the CrossFit Games, those athletes are not training and trying to adapt for the future. They are spending all the adaptations they have built up over months and years, and they are worried about recovery between that workout and the next workout in an hour or two. In that situation, reducing inflammation might be really smart. Like if you want to maximize your performance a couple hours from now, that may be totally appropriate. That does not mean it's a good idea to do all the time in normal training, because you're probably blunting important recovery mechanisms that are helping rebuild your muscles and help you recover overnight and things like that. So just because you see it in that setting doesn't mean it applies equally to your daily training routine.
And I kind of wonder too with those guys, I mean, you might be able to show that just by virtue of doing it so frequently over time, it starts to become associated with some sort of outcome. And there's some kind of psychological switch happening when they do the cold plunge. And maybe this gets to the point we were making earlier about, I have been in conversation with some researchers where as a pre-workout stimulus, it actually has a place. And maybe there's something there when we look at CrossFit Games athletes and athletes that do this kind of in between bouts of training. I don't know. I'm kind of thinking about that as I'm saying it, but I think for me, the cold plunge thing, cause you do see this in a lot of units, a lot of organizations will have cold tubs. It kind of falls into that category with foam rolling, which is one that we'll talk about later, where like, if you think it makes you feel better, then go for it. But there's not like some magical recovery thing happening in the tub.
To wrap up cold plunge, I'll hit some wave tops of three or four studies here.
You should have said ice caps.
There you go. I'll hit the ice caps of three or four studies
here. There we go. Titanic reference.
One that's worth noting, and this is something that a lot of research glosses over, is like individualized differences in responses. So even if the average is no difference, that doesn't mean that different people didn't experience very different results. There do appear to be very individualized responses to cold. So this might be something you experiment with on your own and figure out if you are a positive responder, negative responder, non-responder, things like that. More and more evidence is coming out that post-exercise cold water immersion is uniquely bad for hypertrophy. So if hypertrophy, gaining muscle is your goal, ice baths probably are not your thing.
Stay hot.
But the most recent meta, looking at like all of the data on cold water immersion, strongly cautioned that the overall quality of the evidence in this space is not very good. So that's worth considering. Another good one on team sport athletes, they saw basically no effect on actual performance. The only thing that really changed was perceived soreness, like how they felt about their recovery. That's what you were talking about, Drew. And then we do have a slightly older meta. This is 2020, but still a pretty strong piece, showing negative effects on one rep max, maximum isometric strength, explosiveness, strength endurance, but no significant changes in aerobic metrics. Not to say there was a benefit in aerobic, just no effect whatsoever. So like a lot of those are strength and power kind of outcomes, and they were blunted by cold water immersion.
Yeah, and we'll probably repeat this at the end, but you know, if given the option of jumping into a cold tub or doing like a slow ride on an assault bike, the slow ride on the assault bike is actually what's going to help you with recovery. And you could get into the oxygenation of the muscles and all this sort of energy system stuff we've
save
talked
it,
about.
Drew. Save it. Active recovery is coming later.
I'll save it. But the next one is interesting and certainly a slippery slope. Painkillers.
Yeah, this one wasn't initially on the outline, but I added it because of its prevalence in the military. A lot of people pop in Advil or ibuprofen or something before PT.
That's a psycho move. Are people doing that?
So I dug into the research on this one. So one, yes, it is like a relatively frequent thing in the military for people to take painkillers before exercise.
Jesus.
Again, so like nerdy terms, right? If you want to look at the research, this is called prophylactic use of analgesics or painkillers or NSAIDs. There is, in fact, some research on this in sports. It is uncommon with recreational level athletes, but it is common to the point of being a concern for medical providers at the pro level. When you start looking at guys who are trying to train through injury to extend contracts and things like that, to the point that some estimates say over 50% of professional soccer players are slamming painkillers, even like pre-workout or pre-game, things like that, just to like manage latent levels of pain.
I mean, hopefully we don't have to dive too deep to kind of dispel any would-be advocates of the painkiller approach.
Yeah, there's a lot of side effects here that you got to worry about, especially with long-term use of these things.
Just a weird habit to develop.
But even if there weren't a bunch of side effects and other concerns about addiction and things like that, again, all the studies will be in the show notes here, but a pretty good, I think 2020 or 2021 study summarizing a whole bunch of other studies. They looked at several studies that had evidence on this. Ignoring long-term side effects and things like that, and just looking at effects on performance, they found no effect, no evidence that prophylactic pre-training use of NSAIDs had any benefit for muscle pain or inflammation.
Which, so it doesn't again, even work. Is not to say that there is not a place for these types of things. I mean,
yeah, acute pain management is a thing. Sure. If you got an injury, treat the injury.
But if you're sore from squats and you think ibuprofen is the answer, now you could get a big bottle of ibuprofen and use it as a foam roller, which we'll talk about, but don't start popping pills to alleviate soreness. That's a bad idea.
It's a bad idea. And there also is some evidence, not the greatest evidence, but some evidence that using these painkillers, depending on the variety of painkiller you select, can suppress muscle protein synthesis. So it's also undermining your gains.
Mm-hmm. What's next?
Another one that's massively ramped up in popularity over the last few years, massage guns. Drew, do you own or use a massage gun?
Yes, and yes, I've been given them in the past. I don't know if I've ever actually purchased one. And interestingly, I used one like yesterday or 2 days ago, just because I was sitting in my office and my back was sore. And I think you'll get into this. Like, it feels pretty good.
That is a topic we'll talk about. I don't personally own any, but I have certainly used them on a few occasions. I think it felt like okay, but not so good that I ran out and bought one by any means. Looked at a couple studies here. There are a decent number, especially recently. I think researchers are responding to the popularity of these things. But overall, despite their massive popularity, there's not a lot of evidence that they do anything
they
at
make
all
me itch.
Other than maybe feel good.
Yeah, they make me, I was itch. So back to the
itching third. Is weird. That's a weird response.
Well, but no, so I did it and I was doing it in my physical therapist's office. And he said that the itching is pretty standard because you're basically punching yourself, you get increased blood flow rising to the surface. And that's what's creating this itching sensation. So sort of a tangent, but there's that.
We're off of ice baths and to like neutral temperature interventions now. So I'm going to go back to wave tops instead of ice caps.
Nice.
But some wave tops from the couple studies I looked at. ACSM did a big literature review of a whole bunch of different recovery technologies, and they concluded that percussive gun assisted massage, which is the fancy term for massage guns, lacks convincing evidence concerning athlete recovery. And I think that's particularly notable because the study was supportive of several interventions that I would say also have questionable evidence. So even with their relatively low bar for evidence, they said massage guns weren't super effective. And then a study looking more specifically just at massage guns not only didn't find any benefits for strength, balance, acceleration, agility, or explosive activities, there were indications that it might actually have a negative effect on those things. They did say, though, in fairness to massage guns, they were shown to be somewhat effective for stiffness reduction, range of motion, and then oddly strength improvements after a fatigue protocol, even though they had a negative effect on strength without the fatigue protocol.
Yeah, I think the stiffness thing is interesting because, again, I keep referencing foam rolling, but I guess just sort of any, what would you categorize all those as? Proprioceptive? I don't know.
Yeah.
Recovery modalities?
Sure.
I think it's one of those that if it gives you, if a lot of times stiffness and reduced range of motion have a psychosomatic.
Or at least a neural.
Sure. Of some sort at play. And so if you are able to override that, and this is a little bit nerdy, but override that psychologically, because again, mm-hmm. you've just punched yourself with a massage gun, then is it effective? Sure. I know a lot of people like myself included, like, oh, you know, my traps are tight or whatever. My lats, I have like a knot in my quad and you just that thing like feels pretty good.
Yeah. There's a pain tolerance thing at play here.
But you know, having said all that, I think they're overpriced. You don't really need all those attachments, like whatever, just get a reciprocating saw and put a lacrosse ball on the end of it and go to town.
I will add one quick caveat warning story, I don't know, to cap off the massage guns thing before we move on to the next topic. But as I dug into the research on this, you also bump into some like medical literature rather than performance literature. There's at least one case report of an anemic person using a massage gun and the combination of those things producing an extremely severe case of rhabdo. The case was so extreme that they called her creatine kinase levels undetectably high. Like they were so high that the test no longer worked. It capped out what the test could measure. So if you are anemic or at risk of anemia or anything like that, this might be one to avoid.
Yeah, you can break down your muscle fibers if you hit them really hard over and over and over again.
People also get rhabdo from car accidents. Yeah. Like impact is a way to mess yourself.
That's like one of those, you know, I've seen the one about the lady that died from sniffing popcorn.
What?
She like made, so it was something, this whole thing came out about like the fumes from the popcorn bag when you take it out of the microwave are like toxic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lady,
okay. Turns out she made like 100 bags a day for a month or something. So
that's like, I read one recently about a guy who died from black licorice.
Oh, dude, that stuff sucks.
So it depends on how you feel about the taste of fennel, basically. Some people like it, some people hate it. We always have our good disagreements. Here's one. I like black licorice. I'm a weirdo. I understand that. I enjoy black licorice.
It's disgusting.
But this particular individual, I was reading about it. I think he was like morbidly obese already. And a piece of that was he developed this like increasingly bad like strawberry licorice habit, which doesn't have the ingredient that was the concern here. So he got up to the point where he was consuming like upwards of 5 or 8 or even 10 bags of strawberry flavored licorice products a day.
Like Twizzlers?
Yeah. And then like overnight, then overnight he switched to black licorice.
Oh.
And a 10 bag a day licorice habit when you switch to black licorice had some pretty severe consequences.
So, you know, all things in moderation, licorice, yes. Popcorn, massage guns.
There you go.
Just be careful out there, guys. It's a dangerous world. Stretching.
Should we get this one back on track? Sure.
Yeah. This is becoming a stretch. So let's bring it back to stretching.
Do you want to do your take first and I'll do mine?
Yeah. So stretching for me, one thing that I've always done and people that have been on the Long and Strong program or have worked with us one-on-one will have seen this, but the research will show, and I'm sure you'll dive into this, like static stretching doesn't really do anything, and that's fair, but I like to superset.
Ooh, I don't know if I agree with the claim enough. That static stretching doesn't do anything.
Fair enough. But I like to superset stretching with, like, for example, compound movement. So popular one that I give a lot of people is a back squat, and then you go into a hip flexor stretch or a couch stretch. And what I have found from doing that for many, many years with many, many different people is that you do open up sort of a temporary range of motion, if you will, which then allows you to increase said range of motion under load when you go back to the weighted movement. So I think in like that specific use case, there's a lot of goodness. I don't know if that would necessarily count as recovery, but for me, and when I think of stretching, that's kind of the first place that my head goes. But please enlighten us with the evidence.
I'm gonna come at Drew a little bit here. I'm gonna disagree on a couple counts. Not that I don't agree with the things he's saying. I just don't agree that what he's talking about is recovery.
Squatting? That's fair. I would agree with that.
Well, stretching. I think a lot of people think about stretching as recovery. And full disclosure, I did not put stretching on the outline for this episode. Drew added it when he went into the outline and started adding things. Because I wouldn't, frankly, despite how people talk about it, I would not classify stretching as recovery. I would classify it as its own modality of training. And when Drew talks about static stretching not really doing anything, he's probably referencing static stretching doesn't really reduce injury risk, things like that. And it doesn't. But static stretching done well, which usually involves longer reps and more sets and higher intensities than people think, absolutely can be effective at improving range of motion. It's just that range of motion may or may not be relevant. If it's a range of motion you need access to for tasks you want to do or like movements you want to be able to do, it's super relevant. But that's, you're just training for more range of motion. You're not recovering from some other thing.
Fair.
I'll highlight Range of Strengths page on Instagram. He's got some really cool content on different like ways and tactics for stretching and how to program it and things like that. If your goal is greater range of motion, if no part of your goal includes greater range of motion, stretching might be a waste of your time.
Well, I would disagree with your disagreement. In fact, because
I'm not surprised.
Because if, and just to go ahead and confuse everyone out there, but like, if would you include yoga as stretching?
I would include yoga as stretching, yes.
So I would think yoga, there's definitely a place in the recovery lexicon for yoga.
Potentially, but I would just lump it in as active recovery because you're going to have to do it at a really low intensity, because if you do it at a higher intensity, you are training. Like, there are lots of people for whom yoga is their training and they get very fit that way.
They're called yogis.
That is true.
So what do we think? Stretching, good for recovery? I'm going to say yes.
As a recovery, like, I think stretching is good if being more flexible is your goal. But like, again, Wavetops of the research found a pretty good meta, lots of different studies between group comparisons showed no effect of post-exercise stretching on strength recovery when compared to passive recovery. No effect of post-exercise stretching on 24, 48, or 72-hour post-exercise muscle soreness compared to passive recovery.
Yeah,
I think if your goal is recovery, it's kind of a waste of your time. If your goal is improved range of motion or just some like low intensity activity to get some of the active recovery benefits.
So you're going to say if stretching calms you down post session, because I agree with you, like, fine, I'm going to touch my toes for a while, whatever. But the parasympathetic response would put you into a different state that would make recovery.
I think you would, if we're relying entirely on the parasympathetic response, I think you would get more benefit from just lying down quietly and, or if you have enough time, taking a nap.
Chaturanga.
Yeah. That's not stretching though.
I can count on zero fingers the number of times I've gone to the research to support my use of stretching. So I guess I don't know if at the end of this we've agreed or disagreed, but long story short,
I think we've mostly got ourselves caught up in semantics. I stretch and I love yoga. I need to get back. I used to do hot yoga all the time and I want to get back into it.
Well, then you're getting awesome into the sauna conversation.
But I don't do it for recovery purposes. I do it as its own thing.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think my takeaway here is if you're listening to this and you're like, oh, I better not stretch, you've missed the point. Like, stretch, please stretch.
Yeah.
It's good for you. That's it.
Cool.
Foam rolling.
Semantics.
This is the one. This is what everyone came here for.
And this one, I think, might have the most citations in my outline.
Foam rolling is stupid. I don't actually think that. I do think that, but I think maybe less.
I think it's applied wrong. I think that's one thing. And one of the things that frustrates me the most, and I think I've talked to people about this before.
Foam rolling their IT bands, because that is actually stupid.
So we're going to talk about some of that stuff. I don't think I've told this story on the podcast, but I've definitely had this conversation with a few folks about like my learning journey in fitness stuff. One of the classes we taught when I was at the Army Physical Fitness School was like a myofascial release class, which is a fancy way of saying foam rolling or rolling using other things other than foam. And like the intro to the course, there'd be like a whole talk about like trigger points and how they work and how to find them and like what they're doing and like fascia getting bound up and stuff. And it was really disheartening to then go into research and find that none of those claims were true.
Yeah, fascia is kind of hit or miss.
Fascia stuff is all over the place. We like drastically oversimplify it like to justify some of this stuff. I think, Drew, you and I both like Kelly Starrett, but there's some like not very evidence-based claims about fascia in Supple Leopard.
Yeah.
I love the book. There's lots of good stuff in there. I've used stuff from it. I would recommend stuff from it. I would just maybe caution people.
We should get him on.
I really want to. I'm gonna do some inside baseball out in the open here. Kelly Starrett is gonna be at this year's H2F symposium. He will be, I think, like keynote speaking or something like that. I will be working every angle I can to try and leverage that opportunity to get him to agree to come on this podcast.
There we go. Phone rolling.
So let's dig into it. I would suggest that based on the literature, foam rolling is probably better supported as a warm-up than as a recovery modality. Now that might be the same thing, right? Like if you're coming into a workout sore from a previous workout and foam rolling helps you get ready for the workout you're going into, maybe that is recovery. Depends on how you define it. I'd say effect sizes in most of these studies are small or negligible, but in the studies where they do find some effect, you're looking at dosing of 90 to 120 second sets per area, like muscle area you're working on. And where effects have been seen, unsurprisingly, range of motion, but also sprinting. Effects have not really been seen in strength or jumping. This is from a couple of the studies, but using it over the long term seems more likely to produce results than like one single acute bout of it for people who are unfamiliar with it. And then finally, there do seem to be big differences in whether it's effective depending on the muscle or joint you are looking at. So there's plenty of like decent evidence that it does something when you're looking at like quad and hamstring stuff for benefits at your knee and hip joint. But on the other end of the spectrum, like working on calf doesn't seem to have any significant impact on ankle range of motion.
It feels so good.
It does feel good.
I mean, I think most people just foam roll their quads. They just like flop around and then they do a Metcon.
It's tough. I think a lot of people do just kind of flop around on a foam roller and call that a warm up or something, or flop around at the end of a workout and call it recovery or cool down. Mm-hmm. I will say if you dig into the supple leopard stuff and you like follow some of those methods, whether they're evidence-based or not, that feels really good. Scan, smash, pressure wave, all those funky sciencey sounding approaches to self-myofascial release.
What's the thing he does in there with you wrap
tack and floss?
Yeah, you wrap your leg in a rubber band and like flossing, right?
Yeah. So there's various versions. If you just wrap it in the band, that is flossing. Like if you go order floss from Rogue, you're going to get a very expensive strip of whatever rubber you can wrap around. Yeah, good to go. You could probably get it much cheaper from someplace other than Rogue. Anyway,
way cheaper.
But there's versions of it too. So like tack and floss is where you like theoretically you're pinning down the pressure point or whatever thing you're dealing with, and then like forcing movement through it or something. So like I've seen you wrap the floss over a golf ball with the golf ball positioned right on the knot you're trying to deal with. Another version of this I've seen is that you get a kettlebell and you find your knot. Like if it's in your hamstring, you find your knot, you put it on top of the kettlebell, and then you like extend and flex your knee a bunch of times while it's tacked right on that knot you have. Now I say all this having done it, having taught it. Evidence isn't that great that it works, but
like
it feels good.
Saying it out loud is like, I don't know if that.
It's not really how fascia works. And like, there's been some cool
it's
studies.
Not really
on
how
like,
human beings work.
There's been some cool studies on like getting different clinicians to try and identify trigger points and knots and things like that. And there is no consistency on like where they point to it or whether there is one.
But I think all of that gets to the point that we've made and continue to make and will continue to make that like the psychological aspect of this is huge. And if buying some overpriced rubber band from Rogue and wrapping it all the way around your calf until your foot turns purple and jiggling around on a golf ball makes you think you have busted up some knot that doesn't exist, then you've recovered. I mean, like, mission accomplished. And yeah. I mean, for me, foam rolling falls squarely in that category. I will add one thing to this, and it's, I don't know if this would fall into the foam rolling. Maybe you could talk about this from like a cold therapy, but for any of the guys that have trained over the years, myself included, that develop like some foot pain from just running a lot, throwing a lacrosse ball in the freezer and then standing on that thing. Oh my God, that feels good.
They do make ice massage tools.
Of course they do. Probably sell it on Rogue.
Probably. There's one I've seen. I think I've even used it before. That's like a metal ball you put in the freezer. You take it out of the freezer. You put it in this like grip thing that holds it, so you don't have to hold on to the metal ball, and then you can like rub it on wherever you're working.
Oh yeah. Yep.
You want a much simpler version of that I was first exposed to as like a middle schooler or high schooler by a physical therapist or something. Just get Dixie cups, fill them with water, put them in the freezer, rip off the rim of the Dixie cup. So now the ice is exposed at the top. Boom, you've got it for like cents. It's easy.
Maybe we should do it. That'll be a upcoming Instagram post from Alex. Budget recovery tools.
Oh, that there's a whole conversation there.
Yeah, it's an Instagram post.
The Rogue Supernova, very expensive, can be replaced perfectly with just a used softball.
For sure.
The smaller one can be replaced perfectly with a lacrosse ball. The smaller one than that can be replaced with a golf ball.
Golf ball.
A lot of like softer foam rollers that are expensive stop being effective really quickly. Just replace it with a chunk of PVC pipe. Like almost all these things, you can either spend a ton of money on Rogue's website buying the fancy version of it, or almost no money at like Home Depot or the grocery store, or like pick it up. Like you can go to like a golf course and just grab used golf balls.
I do that all the time.
Yeah, there's very cheap ways to do a lot of these things if you don't want the expensive version.
This is an aside, but I built my first set of my first TRX I made at Home Depot for less than $10. Mm-hmm. And my first set of rings I made in the oven with PVC and hot sand.
Wasn't TRX like invented by a Navy SEAL on deployment?
Yeah,
who just
on a,
like
su- on a submarine.
Yeah, like strapped some webbing together. Yeah.
Boom. Done.
Now he's super
now
rich.
He's making a shit ton of money.
Actually, no, they declared bankruptcy like 2 years ago, I think.
I think it was one of those where it just got copyrighted so many times that, or whatever. Yeah.
You know, they technically own like the terms suspension trainer and suspension training.
I don't think the Chinese give a shit. I think they That's just made true. Replicas and sold them on Amazon.
Oh, they're for sure replicas out there all over the place now.
So anyway, foam rolling. Sure. Go for it.
Cool.
You're not doing anything, but it feels good. Kind of, I think massage probably falls into the same. Well,
we didn't put massage on here. It was something I thought if I had more time, I would do some of the research on massage. But just running into a few of the studies I looked at compared a bunch of different recovery modalities, and massage was mentioned on a few of them. And it's the same thing as foam rolling. It feels real good, but there's not really much quantifiable change in performance outcomes, recovery stuff, any of that.
Fair. Okay, this one will be fun. Active recovery. Capital A, capital R, active recovery.
So again, depends on your timeline you're looking at. I did a post recently on the Instagram page saying that active recovery is more about the active than the recovery. Mm-hmm. I think fundamentally it's a great way to accumulate a little bit more activity at a really low intensity. I'm not sure how much it's doing for whatever definition of recovery you have.
I think people screw this up all the time.
Sure.
I think this is the most bastardized. Because at least if you're foam rolling and thinking you're fixing your IT band, like at least you're not like doing active recovery. Like I say that. So I mentioned this earlier and you cut me off appropriately. if you want to get into some of the physiology of the way muscles work and bioenergetics and all that sort of stuff, like oxygenation of the muscle tissue is really what we're after with active recovery, not with active recovery, with recovery in general. And if you strap on something like a nitric oxide device, or I mean, I'm thinking of all the conversations we've had with Evan Picon about this, but like throw one of those on your quad, get some infrared spectroscopy about what's actually going on in the muscle, and watch as you pedal very slowly on a bike and your oxygen levels shoot through the roof. That's recovery. So if I were to prescribe a quote unquote active recovery day, and you're like riding slowly on the bike and then maybe doing like some, you know, offset farmer's carries or something like that would be active recovery. But when we get hit up by a bunch of assholes online saying they did like a 10-mile active recovery run, that's not active recovery. You went for a long run. Like stop perpetuating that myth.
So I don't know about, so I don't know what watch you wear or anything like that, but my Garmin likes to, if I like pick the run activity, it will recommend my workout.
No free ads.
There are other watches. Yeah, that's correct.
I have a Garmin too though.
But if I click the run activity, it will recommend a workout to me based on my like recent training and things like that. And if I've trained a bunch recently, it will recommend a recovery run if it thinks I'm doing too much and need to chill out.
Again, and not a thing.
So I like, and this is a contentious topic because you'll like hear a lot of like marathoners and stuff talk about doing recovery runs or shakeout runs or things like that. Whether or not it exists, we're theoretically here talking specifically to a tactical population. And my recommendation specifically for that population is that knowing that the most common kind of training injury in our population is lower body overuse musculoskeletal injuries largely attributable to running, I tend to recommend pretty strongly against the concept of a recovery run in our population. If you are a fantastic like half marathon, marathon, or longer distance runner, and you want to do a shakeout, couple, 2-3 mile run and call it a recovery run, I'm not going to stop you. You know what you're doing. But in a general purpose with our population, if you're going to grab a platoon or a company or something like that, don't take them for a run and think you're doing recovery.
Yeah. And I keep saying it's not a real thing for that exact reason. Like if you have a sufficient number of training miles logged over years of exposure, then there's probably a place for a recovery run. And I'll go back to the physiology on that. You can literally, there are devices you can buy off the shelf that you can use that will show you, for like an Eliud Kipchoge, who was the 2-hour marathon dude, he could probably run at a pace and a distance that he's reoxygenating his muscles and it is actually active recovery. But to your point, going on a platoon recovery run, I guarantee probably 90% or more of those guys are creating a low oxygen, dare I say, anaerobic environment, which is actually the opposite of what we're after with active recovery. They are having a workout and you are redlining them and calling it active recovery. So I don't know. To me, it's like a really fine line between a quote unquote active recovery workout, yeah, which is in and of itself a little bit of a misnomer. The performance care segments, I think they're called, from Active Life. That's like a, just like a quick YouTube reference I'll throw out there. I use that stuff all the time. I think those are good. And you'll see when you look at those, and actually Marcus Philly, I think, has some good stuff out there too. You'll see sort of a creative combination of monostructural stuff. So like, you know, pedaling slowly on an assault bike or something with some isometric type stuff, planks. You could get into some of the stretching. But the whole intent there is to keep heart rate low, to keep pace down. But man, I've had conversations with people where they're like, yeah, I just did like 100 wall balls for time. It was like an active recovery workout. And those people are idiots.
The two factors I think about primarily if we're going to do something called active recovery, which you mentioned it's a misnomer, and I agree with you. Any kind of session is still going to be a stressor no matter what it is, which is whether you can handle that stressor and whether it produces the outcomes you're looking for. But the biggest things I think about are, one, autoregulation, RPE, because you can make anything easy or anything hard. People might call yoga an active recovery session, but I remember as a platoon leader, I scheduled like a yoga session a couple days before, or maybe the day before our APFT. And the instructor that we got to do our yoga session, I clearly had not communicated the intent of making it like an easy recovery session. And it was incredibly difficult and we were all wrecked and we rescheduled that PT test. And I, same thing like swimming, like some people can probably get some great active recovery from swimming. Just on like a brief aside that I don't think we'll have time for later, but swimming might have some unique active recovery benefits just from like hydrostatic stuff and the water being cold and things like that and like zero impact. But that's not to say swimming will be active recovery for everyone. If you throw a guy who doesn't really know how to swim in the pool, no amount of buoyancy and coldness from the water are going to overcome the fact that he is drowning and that is stressful.
Active drowning recovery.
Yeah. So you have to keep the RPE low no matter what the activity is, because you can turn something intended to be recovery into serious training very quickly. And then again, just based on like the nature of the types of overuse injuries people tend to get, I would avoid high impact activities even at low intensities if the goal is recovery.
Yes.
Random stuff from some of the literature. This made me sad because it made me think back to when I was reading Simple and Sinister by Pavel. Not reading, listening to, because if you're going to consume Pavel content, you have to hear it in his voice. Pavel told me I should be active between every set of everything. I should be walking around or shadow boxing or something between all my sets. That's one place where the research is pretty conclusive. If it's between bouts of high intensity, like a sprint and then another sprint, passive recovery is universally better than active recovery. And that should not come as a surprise that like doing extra activity between your activity prevents you from recovering as fast in the short term.
Take that, David Goggins.
Now, between days of training, active recovery might become more beneficial, but that's mostly if people are sufficiently trained. So if you look at some of the literature, you will see differences. Like trained athletes tend to have better responses to quote unquote active recovery than untrained people. And that's probably because of what percentage of their maximal intensity we're looking at here. So like an untrained person tries to go for a recovery run and they wreck themselves because they weren't ready for that. Marathon runner does it and it works out fine. Have we sufficiently covered active recovery?
I think so.
All right. I think we only got one or two left, right? Yeah, only one left.
Compression garments.
Yeah, compression garments. I haven't honestly seen people talking about this as much recently as I used to. It's a little bit of a pet peeve for mine, and we talk about no free ads. I'm going to do the reverse. And I'm going to call it a company by name because they frustrated me greatly. They show up at like every military fitness related thing, anything tactical, human performance-y. The company's called Defend, but it's just spelled DFND.
They got all the vowels on anything, and it just, for some reason, people think it sounds cooler.
Oh yeah. If anybody here is a hater like me and just wants to get a good hate session, go on their website and start reading some of the stuff. If you go to their FAQ page in particular, the number of spelling and grammatical errors is absolutely astonishing. They also claim that one of their products is chemical free, which is like an absurd thing to say. If you know anything about like how everything is chemicals, like you can't claim that your thing has no chemicals. It literally is chemicals, but whatever.
You can't defend these claims, defend.
Some of the wildest ones, they claim that their garments provide maximum muscle containment. I don't know what muscle containment is.
It keeps your muscles in your body.
But they claim to have done a study with some special operations schoolhouse where wearing Defend compression garments reduced injuries by like 30%, improved graduation rates by 40%.
Which is an insane thing.
Ludicrous numbers, like absolutely off the wall numbers. I don't know how many people listen to this podcast and who's going to share it. I'm probably going to get an angry DM from the guy who runs Defend. I've met him a couple times. Sorry, I don't believe those statements are true.
I'd love to see the evidence.
But we can, so the study they did, they like refused to say who the unit was or when it was or any of those things. Obviously, special operations got to keep it secret. That makes it much easier to make those claims. Although we can't source that one, there's a decent amount of literature out there on compression garments in general. And I think a big one here is that people tend to wear compression garments during the exercise they are doing. The evidence that that does anything is extremely limited. There's some like niche cases for like very technical things. I think like high jump or broad jump, something like that, or counter movement jump. They saw some possible benefit, but I bet that was more in the psychological domain potentially, or maybe proprioceptive or things like that. But for like actual performance of endurance activities, strength activities, things like that, you're going to see little to no effect of wearing compression garments during the activity. Now, there is some evidence supporting wearing compression garments overnight between training days or between days of competition and things like that. Slight reductions in blood lactate, slight reductions in perceived soreness, no change to muscle protein synthesis, things like that, and no changes to repeat bout performance. So not the strongest evidence that it works, but the only studies where you're going to see like real effect most of the time is if you wear these garments for like 8, 12, 15 hours, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, you see a lot of senior citizens wearing compression socks.
Well, if you're worried about deep vein thrombosis, right. Yeah, it might have its place.
And for those of us out there looking to simulate a tummy tuck or just trying to shape up a little bit, I mean,
Do you wear Spanx, Drew? Is that what you're saying?
No, but you know, there could be some soldiers out there doing it, and I think more power to them. I don't think it's recovery necessarily. For me, compression, and you know, I've had my run-ins with Defend as well. It's just one of those things where it's like the price point does not justify the supposed use case. You know, traveling for long distances, especially in an airplane at altitude, that sort of thing. I think that's kind of a different piece that you could argue compression might have a role, but yeah, doing your standard workout and then just throwing on a bunch of compression gear and saying that you reduced injuries by 30% is just
insane,
stupid. Like that's not, you didn't reduce injuries by 30%.
In an effort to keep this thing to roughly the 1 hour mark, which I think we're about to actually achieve, which is pretty cool.
Look at us.
I'm going to really fast go through a few top line takeaways from some of the studies that compared a bunch of different modalities. I tried not to reference these as we went through individual modalities, but just some fast quotes. Massage, cryotherapy, and alternative therapies have not been shown to be consistently effective. Next study. There were no significant differences in exercise performance for any of the tests, regardless of the recovery modality. Next study. The active recovery and electronic recovery instruments presented little evidence supporting their usefulness in accelerating the recovery process. Another one. Cryotherapy plus compression apparel showed no significant difference from passive rest, except for, and this will shock you guys, skin temperature. Your skin does get colder if you do cryotherapy.
What? It gets hotter if you do sauna.
There you go. Shocking results.
Yeah.
And then last one, another quick pull out. The results indicate that cryotherapy combined with compression garments after resistance exercise does not contribute to a faster recovery of physical performance, neuromuscular function, or muscle damage, but promotes recovery of perceptual measures regardless of age. So people do feel better, even if it doesn't really change their performance.
I think to put a bow on it, and I know I'm going to hijack some of your stuff here because I know you're going to talk about some of the less sexy things, but I'll jump ahead. And basically my kind of two key takeaways for a Recovery 101 episode would be these. Number one, and again, referencing sort of the psychological aspect of all of this, recovery is very individualized. I think mm-hmm. you as the universal you as an athlete of one need to try and find what's going to work best for you. And if that means if you're the type of athlete that needs to spend a good chunk of money on gizmos and gadgets because it makes you feel like you're doing the right thing. And I've worked with some of these people, and that's fine. Go for it. But as I think you've made very clear tonight, the evidence is always going to be out there because I don't think you're ever going to reach a critical mass of individuals indicating that something is for sure good or for sure bad. I think it's far too individualized and far too complex to definitively say one way or the other, which is nice on the one hand, because it means that, you know, really anything could work, but it's dangerous on the other hand, because a lot of companies out there have taken advantage of that fact and created gizmos and gadgets and wearables and all kinds of things, saying that they do all these wild claims and you really can't refute it, because it's hard to prove otherwise. And kind of my second point, and this is where I'm going to steal some of your thunder, the best recovery tools are the ones that are not sexy and do not cost anything. Getting more sleep, eating healthier, mitigating stress through whatever means necessary, journaling, meditation, therapy, reorganizing your life, whatever. And then just exposing yourself to more and more appropriate volume over time so that your work capacity increases and what destroyed you before no longer destroys you. That stuff is not super sexy. You can't bottle up sleep and sell it. But I think if you can find a way to create more of that in your life, it will have a much greater impact than the banded frozen lacrosse ball that you bought on Rogue for $200.
So Drew did in fact just steal like all of my thunder for the closing of the episode.
I'm sorry.
But what I will do to kind of wrap that up a little bit is this is not like a practical thing, but more of like a thought experiment sort of thing. I think any recovery modality to be deemed effective should have to be compared to attempting to take a nap for the exact same amount of time as it took to do that thing. Mm-hmm. And I think if you got serious about comparing like a 20-minute sauna to a 20-minute nap, a 20-minute foam rolling session to a 20-minute nap, a 20-minute massage gun session to a 20-minute nap, I think the nap would come out on top almost every time if we were being realistic. Because the effect sizes on these things are smaller than the people selling them want you to think.
Well, and you'll see people sitting there with a dip in and a Bang energy drink on a foam roller, being like, dude, I'm this is like my recovery. It's like, there's low hanging fruit. Like there's fruit on the ground rotting that you haven't taken advantage of if you're that type of person. So hopefully, are there stones left unturned here? I don't think so.
I think we're good.
Great. Hopefully some positive takeaways. You will not find any fancy active recovery gizmos on our website, but please get more sleep.
There we go. We should sell sleep.
We will. We'll bottle up sleep and sell it. Thanks for tuning in. See you guys. Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.